You're with us on The Morning Show as we continue our candidate conversations leading up to the August 11th primary. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Democratic candidate Roger Pollack seeks to challenge first-term U.S. Representative Brian Steil, a Republican in the 1st Congressional District. So Pollack will face Democrat Josh Paid in the August primary. We heard from Paid last week. The winner will take on Steil in the November 3rd general election. Do you live in Janesville, Kenosha, Racine, or another community in the 1st Congressional District? What issues matter to you? What do you think Congress should be doing? We're at 800-642-1234. Roger Pollack is a Racine native, an attorney, and a national security professional. He worked at the U.S. Treasury Department for a decade. Roger, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hey, thank you, Kate. Thank you for having me, and thank you for the listeners out there who have tuned in.
So why are you the best Democratic candidate to face Republican Representative Brian Steil in November?
Thank you. You know, I have the experience that it takes to not only win this election, but represent the people of the 1st District. I grew up in a low-income family where we struggled financially to make ends meet. My mom worked three jobs to keep a roof over our heads as I was a young kid, you know, three low-paying jobs. So I know what it's like to come from a family that struggles. I persevered. I had substantial help from the community. I relied on federal and state assistance programs. I made it to the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And like you said, I served our country. After graduating, I joined the intelligence community, where I worked to stop funding to terrorist organizations in Asia. And I deployed to Afghanistan for almost 2 years, working to stop funding to the Taliban and worked on corruption initiatives in the country. So I've served our country. I've got a record of service. I know what it's like to deploy with our men and women in uniform and work to help keep them safe by stopping funding to the organizations trying to hurt them.
You mentioned, go ahead.
I was going to say, I also worked on the Iran nuclear agreement. I've sat face-to-face with Iranian officials to get that deal implemented. And I also sat face-to-face with Chinese officials who are trying to discriminate against U.S. companies. So I've worked on some of the most substantial foreign policy initiatives in our country. And I've been at the table when major decisions have been made, and I've got a record of service, and I know what it's like to come from a family that struggles to make ends meet, like a lot of families here in the district.
So I hear a couple themes here: foreign policy, international affairs, and with safety net programs in mind from your roots. So if you're elected to Congress, what are three things that you want to accomplish?
Yeah, thank you. You know, a big thing that we need to do is shore up our healthcare system. We need to make sure that individuals have access to universal, affordable, good quality healthcare coverage and low prescription drug prices. That will be a huge effort of mine. You know, the incumbent Brian Steil has voted against efforts that would allow the U.S. government to negotiate on behalf of pharmaceutical companies to bring the cost of prescription drug prices down. I think that's horrible and would absolutely work hard to bring those prescription drug prices down. Another thing is getting big money out of politics. That's really the root of all evil in our country. It prevents us from making tough decisions on climate, on gun control, on a whole host of issues, including healthcare. And so if we can reduce and get rid of corporate PAC contributions and close the loopholes that allow dark money to influence politics, get lobbyist money out of politics, that would make a huge difference. The third thing is, I think we need to work on climate change and infrastructure and have a large infrastructure program that, like I said, works to reduce carbon emissions, brings our economy into the 21st century, and in the process helps create jobs in southeastern Wisconsin.
You mentioned getting money out of politics. How will you fund your campaign?
I have run a completely grassroots campaign. Proud to state that in the first quarter of this year, we outraised Brian Steil and individual contributions. We're running a strong campaign. We've got a great team and are primed to win the primary and take it to Brian Steil. We're not taking any money from corporate PACs and are, like I said, running a completely grassroots campaign.
We're talking with Roger Pollack, a Democratic candidate for Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District. It's part of our candidate conversations leading up to the August primary election. Taking your questions for Pollack at 800-642-1234. On the issue of climate change, what steps should Congress take to address climate change?
Thank you. We need to, you know, under the Trump administration, the Environmental Protection Agency has rolled back regulations substantially related to greenhouse gas emissions. And we need to, if the new administration, and I'm going to be working hard to make sure that's Joe Biden, I hope the EPA writes itself, but if not, Congress needs to codify regulations and law to prevent administration from administration to reduce environmental protection. So that's one thing. I think an infrastructure program that that prioritizes greenhouse, that prioritizes green infrastructure projects that brings our economy into the 21st century with things like increased public transportation infrastructure, with charging stations, greater reliance on green energy production is hugely important. And like I said, that would increase jobs in southeastern Wisconsin. And I firmly believe that if given the opportunity, southeastern Wisconsinites can compete with anybody across the country. And we've shown that for centuries now. And I look forward to voting on bills that and champion bills that help the people of southeastern Wisconsin participate in this new economy and help lead it.
Let's bring in Bill now in Kenosha. Hi. Oh, Bill is no longer there, but Bill wanted you to address, how do you build coalitions? Bill says we're not acting as a unified country right now. How would you work across the aisle?
Thank you for that question, Bill. And, I have a history of working across the aisle. I worked both in the Bush and Obama administration on national security, have a long, proud history of working with Republicans to get things done, to prevent funding from going to terrorist organizations. When I was in Afghanistan for almost 2 years, there was no Democrat or Republican. We were working to get the job done. And I worked not only with U.S. officials, but with officials across the world to get things done. And I think we need to focus on, of course, bridging gaps here in the United States, but also reinvigorating our alliances around the world to tackle issues like climate change and human rights. I have a long, proud history of working across the aisle, and I've got, the experience to be taken seriously from day one in Congress.
The presidential race will be at the top of ballots in November. What is your view of President Trump's response to the pandemic so far?
I think, first off, the number one priority of the president, of the government, is to keep Americans safe, and the president has not done that. It would have been difficult, of course, to stop coronavirus from entering this country. But once here, the leadership was sorely lacking. Getting rid of the pandemic response group that President Obama had put in place was obviously a poor decision. And it's a history repeating itself of just getting rid of initiatives that the Obama administration had done just for the sake of it. And so, I think we should have had policies in place already for getting critical supplies out to hospitals and had that stockpiled and had a real strategy to tackle this and not say that, we're going to stop it in its tracks day one. It's just a few people. It's going to be down to zero before long. But take this seriously as the pandemic that it is and not put pressure on states to open early, not put pressure on schools to open early. And so I think the Trump administration's response to this has been horribly lacking.
We're having candidate conversations leading up to the 2020 elections. Today, it's with Democratic candidate Roger Pollack, who is running for Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District. The district covers Kenosha, Racine, Walworth counties, parts of three neighboring counties, including the city of Janesville. How do you think Congress should tackle big issues like the coronavirus, like unemployment, policing, climate change, as we've been talking about, immigration, education? How do you feel about Congress? What grade would you give it? Which proposals are you following in the House or the Senate? Join in at 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with candidate Roger Pollack here on the Ideas Network. It's Candidate Conversations here on The Morning Show. I'm Kedar Cherkent. We have Roger Pollack, a Democratic candidate for Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District. He aims to challenge Republican U.S. Representative Brian Steil, and he first takes on Josh Paid in the August primary election. Who has your vote for the Democratic primary in the 1st Congressional District? Are you voting for Roger Pollack or Josh Pade? What is your thinking? What issues matter to you most in congressional elections? Join in 800-642-1234. And candidate Roger Pollack stays with us for 10 more minutes. Let's take another call now. Sam is joining us from Madison. Hi, Sam.
Hello.
Hi.
So my question was specifically for national security. You mentioned that you had experience on the Iran nuclear deal. And I think part of the deal that was the most confusing to me was the waiting time between discovering an illegal nuclear weapons activity at an unidentified site and the time that the inspectors were allowed to come in, which I think Harvard Belfer Center said was somewhere between 30 and 90 days. And I was kind of curious if you were on that group, why the waiting time as long as that was negotiated as opposed to something shorter.
Sam, thanks. Hey, Roger?
Yeah, thanks for that question, Sam. You know, the deal was struck over the course of over a year and a half of negotiations, and there was certainly give and take on all fronts, but it's a deal that prevented Iran from absolutely getting a nuclear weapon, one that did it with verification, one that had UN inspectors continually monitoring the levels of production on a continual basis. And so it was a situation where we made sure that there were proper verifications in place to get that deal done, and snapback opportunities for sanctions quickly re-implemented if we felt like the deal was not being adhered to. So we felt very good about the parameters of the deal, and I'm personally very frustrated that the deal was ripped up, and we saw what happened with our relations with Iran when that happened. You know, there was immediate hostilities in the Gulf, and then things spiraled out of control. So it showed me very quickly that getting out of the deal was wrongheaded, and I think it's again an example where the Trump administration has backed out of activities that the Obama administration did that were good for our country and good for the world, just for the sake of it.
Sam, thanks. Let's bring in Bud now in Janesville with a question. Hi, Bud.
Hello there. Say, my wife and I, we both work for small employers, and we pay healthcare premiums totaling $16,000 annually, plus we have a $6,000 deductible on top of that. I'm just wondering if Mr. Pollack, right, Pollack?
Yeah,
if he's in the favor of universal healthcare.
Bud, thanks. What is your view on universal healthcare and the high costs of Bud's premium and deductible?
Yeah, thank you, Bud. I absolutely believe that universal quality health care is a human right. We need to ensure that everyone in this country has access to a plan that meets their needs, that does so affordably. And, you know, Bud, I sympathize with the cost of your health care. And I think we need to have a situation where choice is still available for individuals, but have a plan in place that is absolutely accessible and affordable for everyone that is dissatisfied with their employer-backed health insurance.
Well, how do you pay for that? Because by way of taxes, how would you adjust or change our country's taxes and personal income on personal income or corporations as you look to ensure health care for everyone?
Yeah, thank you. The corporate tax loopholes that exist, if closed, would free up hundreds of billions of dollars. And I think we need to look at our tax codes that have allowed corporations to reap in record profits while in low-income and working-class families are struggling. So there is a lot of room in the U.S. tax code to shore up our costs, including health insurance. And I think we look at the corporate tax loopholes that have been put in place by the Trump administration and close those. Absolutely.
How do you do that? How do you make those changes and ensure that others are on board?
Well, exactly what we talked about earlier. You work across the aisle. I am hopeful that the come November, we have a Democratic-controlled House, Senate, and presidency, you know, executive office. But if that's not the case, then you have to work across the aisle and make tough decisions that are palatable for both sides. And I mean, the legislative process exists. It's worked for hundreds of years. It's broken down recently, but I'm hopeful. And, you know, again, with my experience working with both Republicans and Democrats, we'll be working hard to reach across the aisle to get things done, get hard things done.
Let's look at trade for a moment. Do you support the USMCA, the United States-Mexico-Canada trade agreement that President Trump pursued to replace NAFTA?
I do support the agreement. You know, it is it's an improvement over NAFTA. There are still, you know, improvements to be made on the environment side, and you know, I think we need to, in future trade agreements, bring unions and labor into the negotiating process early and often to make sure that they are well looked out for, and for farmers as well here in southeastern Wisconsin. But it is an improvement over NAFTA, and you know, I would look forward to working on future trade agreements that include high standards for, again, environmental and labor standards going forward.
You mentioned farmers. We've seen the surge of bankruptcies, especially on dairy farms going dark. What would you do for farmers?
Yeah, farmers, like I said, farmers have helped build up our country in southeastern Wisconsin. Of course, you know, there's a proud tradition of farming communities. And I think we need to make sure that farmers have access to new technologies to work in a way that's more efficient, that have access to there's ways to make money from the green economy on farms, solar power, wind power, as ways to increase revenue. And, you know, I am for federal programs that support farmers in times of need. And so, you know, would be working to strengthen those programs as well.
Should the federal government offer more incentives to companies or to households to reduce carbon emissions? What would that look like?
You know, it's important to reduce carbon emissions at all levels, in corporations and in households. You know, I think the electric vehicle subsidies is a great way to induce lowering emissions, you know, so I'm fully supportive of those.
Looking at immigration, what ways would you support changing our nation's immigration system?
You know, our immigration system is obviously broken. Immigrant employers employ about one out of every 10 employers in this country. And we absolutely need to fix a system where individuals who come into our country have a pathway to citizenship. And I fully support the DREAM Act to make sure that DREAMers have a pathway to citizenship. I think we need to have a policy on immigration that is fair and grounded in human rights and dignity, and you know, certainly end separation of children and families at the border. I think that's abhorrent behavior. And again, have a pathway to legal citizenship. I think I'm for increasing our quotas on individuals who come here as asylum seekers to make sure that the United States is a place where people can seek refuge and start a new life. And we need you know, immigrant labor here in the United States and immigrant labor that is treated fairly and given proper wages. So I'm fully in favor of immigration reform. I think we need to do that.
I want to look more closely at the debate on Capitol Hill right now about a second stimulus package. Should Congress extend the weekly unemployment benefits that expire at the end of this month? And at what level, if you agree with that?
Thank you. I do believe that the $600 unemployment benefits should be extended. You know, we have no problem giving hundreds of billions of dollars in bailouts to large corporations. I should say, you know, Republicans have no problem doing that. And a lot of these large corporations wouldn't be around without U.S. support, federal government support in the financial crisis, and again, what we're seeing right now. And I'm not saying we shouldn't do that, but we can't turn a blind eye to families and say, oh, you know, they're getting too much money right now when again, we're doling out hundreds of billions of dollars to large corporations. I think it's important that families have what they need in this time of crisis dealing with all the psychological stresses. And again, I come from a low-income family where we struggled considerably to make ends meet. So I know what it's like to be a child in one of these families right now that are having anxiety about paying rent. And I think it's criminal, the fact that we have a Congress that has totally dragged their feet, the Republican Party has dragged their feet in getting this bill passed in time before the stimulus increase has run out. And it's, you know, there's an easy solution here, and it's just yet another example of Republican members of Congress, including Brian Steil, prioritizing corporations over working class families.
Roger, thank you for joining us.
Hey, thank you so much for having me, Kate, and thank you for the listeners out there.
Roger Pollack is a Democratic candidate for Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District. The district covers Kenosha, Racine, and Walworth counties and parts of 3 neighboring counties. Coming up, we talk about the renewed push to quit smoking amid the pandemic. Were you able to quit? What worked for you? 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network. We're talking about how to quit a nicotine habit here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. The WHO, the World Health Organization, warns that COVID-19 poses significant risks to smokers because of the way the infectious disease attacks the lungs. The WHO says there's evidence that smokers are more at risk of developing the most severe coronavirus symptoms than people who do not smoke. Are you in a smoking cessation program? How is it going? How is stress caused by the pandemic affecting your desire to reach for a cigarette or to vape? What do you do instead? Be part of this at 800-642-1234. Doug Jornby is Director of Clinical Services for the Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention at UW-Madison. He's a clinical psychologist and professor of medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Doug, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
How does the pandemic complicate the matter to try to quit a nicotine habit, to try to quit smoking?
Well, you certainly hit it on the head talking about the fact that it's a novel source of stress and has been now for several months for a lot of people. And of course, we know that people who are smoking, you know, one of their go-to ways of coping with that is to pick up a cigarette. So it's certainly been a challenge. On the other hand, I think it also poses a lot of opportunities for people as well.
What types of opportunities do you see at this moment?
Well, when you think about, you know, what are some very common triggers for people, being in the workplace, even though most workplaces in Wisconsin have been smoke-free for some time, what that's done in a lot of cases is it's shifted people's behavior. So if you can't light up at your desk the way people could once upon a time, these days it's more the case of you go outside to a designated smoking area, and that often involves going out at the same time with, you know, maybe the handful of people at work who smoke. So suddenly it's not just a way of warding off nicotine withdrawal symptoms, but it's an opportunity to socialize, to get some support, to get a break from work. And, you know, two out of those three things are pretty basic to functioning well as human beings. We don't want to lose those. Mm. So now with a number of people across the state who have been out of their traditional workplaces, you know, in some cases for months, like folks at the university, you've got a chance to disrupt that whole pattern. And particularly so because there are a lot of people who choose not to smoke in their homes. So there's associations there that essentially you get to bypass and may be able to eliminate some of those habitual triggers for having a cigarette.
As you look at more closures with bars and nightclubs, diminished population going out to bars and nightclubs, that too might have an impact on the number of people smoking.
Absolutely. I don't think it's quite as intense as it was before, you know, taverns became smoke-free in Wisconsin, which was a huge step forward. But certainly that's a situation where a lot of people, even if they have to step outside the physical establishment to smoke, would be doing that, especially if alcohol was involved. And again, that's a high-risk situation that people, in some cases, whether they want to or not, when taverns are closed, it's just not available to them. And so you're taking away some of the things that produce the strongest urges, or we know in a lot of cases contribute to people who have quit recently relapsing back to smoking.
What are the biggest culprits for relapse?
It's changed over time. Like we were saying a moment ago, certainly the not being able to light up inside in taverns has been a big part, but we have seen some consistency over the years too when we've tracked what's difficult for people, and a very large percentage of relapses involve people drinking alcohol. Because there's a real negative synergy there. Not only does it increase the strength of urges and cravings that people have, but you know, if they've had more than a couple drinks, they may not be particularly well prepared to cope with that. We also know that, you know, negative emotions, feeling sad, feeling anxious, feeling isolated, those are all significant contributors, and they have not been in short supply these last few months.
We're talking with Doug Jorenby, clinical psychologist and professor of medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. We're looking at quitting nicotine amid the pandemic and the challenges around it. Have you relapsed back into smoking or vaping during the pandemic? What triggered it? What do you want to ask about how to quit? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Doug, you know, some people are what you would call casual smokers, smoking on special occasions. Is that a slippery slope? When does that become a habit?
Yeah, those people are actually quite rare. We've had the opportunity to study some cohorts of people here at UW-Madison, you know, particularly folks who are going through the undergrad experience, and found that people who consistently say only smoke on weekends or only smoke at parties are not daily smokers are actually a pretty small percentage of the whole population. And during that kind of pivotal phase when folks are in their early to mid-20s, most of them transition out either to stop smoking completely. About a third of them will escalate into daily smoking, and then a smaller percentage just keep going on. Now, I should qualify that by saying that all that work was done before vaping entered the picture, and that has changed things in a number of ways as well.
Well, let's talk about vaping. What have you seen emerge as the vapers, become much more popular at whole age ranges, from young kids to later adults?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's hard to believe with everything that's happened recently, but it was almost exactly a year ago, and kind of in many ways starting here in Wisconsin, that there was a tremendous concern about the emergence of cases of vaping-related pulmonary illness, what eventually ended up with the awkward acronym EVALI. Folks at the Children's Hospital in Milwaukee were some of the first to identify clusters of people that developed very severe lung disease and unfortunately in many cases died. And that actually spread out nationwide. So that was an extreme example, but it certainly brought home a couple of important points. One, that vaping is something that's going on across the spectrum. It's often presented as something that's mostly about younger people, and there's certainly an element of truth to that, but in no way is it exclusive to young people. Unfortunately, there were people in their 50s and older that died of EVALI. It also made it very evident that while we're talking in the context of nicotine here, and certainly a lot of the products out there for vaping include nicotine, sometimes users aren't aware of that. But the technology is relatively agnostic. And when all was said and done, the smoking gun really seemed to be people that were using that vaping technology to get cannabis, and there were contaminants in the e-juice supply that were related to some of the worst cases of EVALI.
Well, let's bring in a call now. Jacob is with us from Eau Claire this morning. Hi, Jacob.
Hello.
Hi.
So my question for the guest is, so the
some cigarettes, like the Marlboros, have like 60, 70 additives, some of them being rat poison. And so I was wondering if your guest knew anything about something like the American Spirit brand is organic tobacco. And I was wondering if like that would be, quote unquote, better for you.
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's one I've heard many, many times over the years from folks. And it is hard to believe that you know, adding elements. It's interesting you cited Marlboro because they're one of the most infamous cases, not with rat poison, but with adding ammonia to the tobacco, which increases the bioavailability of it. In a sense, it makes it easier for people to become dependent on it. Unfortunately, even tobacco products that don't have a lot of extra chemicals added to them doesn't really seem to make a big difference in terms of the classic health risks involved with smoking, you know, things like heart disease, lung disease, risk for cancer in various locations. We obviously don't know anything specifically about the relationship of type of tobacco to COVID because it's so new, the work hasn't been done. But it doesn't appear that that's particularly a safe alternative to traditional commercial cigarettes.
Jacob, thank you for the call. There was also this early on thinking that vaping could be a substitute for cigarette smoking. What do you see there?
Yeah, well, we've really seen a mixed bag with that. Clearly, that's something that's very attractive to people who are smoking, dependent on tobacco. And the interesting thing is, the one thing we can say with great consistency about vaping is the Food and Drug Administration in the U.S. has never allowed companies that make vaping products, e-cigarettes, to claim that they're an effective treatment. Mm. But despite that, there's immense appeal to people. And what we find in the real world is it's very common that people who are smoking cigarettes will get an e-cigarette with the idea that they're going to transition to vaping. Unfortunately, in most cases, what happens is they cut back on their cigarettes, which is probably good in the bigger sense, but they don't stop completely. And so they become what are called dual users, people who smoke typically when they can, if they can afford cigarettes, if they're in an environment that allows it, and the other times that they vape. And so in some ways, especially as we're learning that there are health risks specific to vaping, it kind of becomes the worst of both worlds.
Mm. We're talking about quitting smoking during the pandemic with clinical psychologist Doug Jornby. He heads up clinical services for the UW-Madison Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention. Have you relapsed back into smoking or vaping during the pandemic? What is causing it? What do you want to ask about how to quit? How are you helping a friend or a family member recover from a nicotine addiction? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Doug Jornby here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Let's get back to talking about addiction to cigarettes and vaping and steps to quit during the pandemic. We have UW-Madison clinical psychologist Doug Jornby, who stays with us. Let's take another call now. Joe is joining us from Star Lake this morning. Hi, Joe.
Hi. Thanks for doing this show. We've had members of our own family die as a result of tobacco use. So I had a question. I know the number was remarkably high of people who had premature deaths from tobacco when I was really looking at the subject, which would be in the early 2000s. I don't know what that number is now, but I thought if you could give us that number and then compare it with the number of deaths from coronavirus and compare the different reactions of society, how drastic this one has been versus how we think of tobacco as a product in the commercial world. That's my question.
Joe, thanks. Big questions there, Doug.
Yeah. Well, and to begin with, I'm sorry that, Joe, your family has had that experience of losing some people to tobacco, because it's a very difficult thing. And, you know, you can compare the numbers. Obviously, with the coronavirus, it's a moving target. We probably haven't even seen the peak yet in the U.S., much less globally, until we have a widespread effective treatment for that. It's going to be very difficult to tell. Unfortunately, we know all too well about tobacco that it year after year is just very consistent. In the U.S. alone, it's over 400,000 people that die from a variety of tobacco-related causes, most commonly heart disease, but also pulmonary diseases, cancer, strokes, other conditions that are caused by tobacco. And globally, there are places where the death toll is still climbing. The projections for China, where over half of adult males are smokers, just the lung cancer death rates alone projected out into the middle of the century are just, they're shocking when you look at what the numbers are. You know, it's a little bit of apples and oranges, because for the most part, we're talking about people who are affecting themselves directly by smoking, although secondhand smoke or environmental tobacco smoke is also an independent risk factor for people who are choosing not to smoke but are nonetheless exposed to it. But it's a very different kind of public health scenario than we're talking about with an infectious coronavirus.
Okay. Let's bring in Greg now in Sheboygan. Greg, hi.
Hello. I'm a smoker, and I quit for 10 months and 27 days. And then this COVID thing came, and I started up again. But I'm just wondering, because I can hardly breathe. I take an inhalant, and it's really destroyed my life, because I was very active in the outdoors and things like that. And it's very hard for me to do that, because I have to stop every block or so and catch my breath. But either way, I'm wondering about this. When I was a kid, I used to use cigarettes, and I'd put them on a fuse of an M80, stick it on a tree, and go into the other woods and wait for the deer to all be scared out. But you can't use it as a fuse no more, because they put these things in there so that it goes out. If you're not inhaling on your cigarette, you can be walking down the street with a cigarette in your hand and take a drag off, and it's not burning anymore because it went out, so that you won't start fires in your house and things like that. If you fall asleep, they made these cigarettes so they won't burn. What does that do to me? Hmm. What is that doing? What am I? I'm inhaling and something to make it inflammable. And what is this
chemical doing? Yeah. Doug, can you help us understand the construction of the cigarette?
Yeah. Well, first, I want to congratulate you on quitting for over 10 months. That is a tremendous accomplishment, and I really hope that you can kind of regroup and get back to being smoke-free, because I think definitely in terms of what you were saying about, you know, having to pause and take breaks when you're walking would help with that. And I'm also immensely entertained by your story about the M80s, because that is one way of using a cigarette. I will confess, I have never heard in all the decades.
Well, you run experiments, this. Doug, you know? I mean...
Yeah, well, maybe we'll have to get a dispensation to use M80s in our research. But yeah, you're absolutely right in terms of how the cigarettes, and particularly the papers that they are rolled in for commercial cigarettes, were changed. And it specifically was the case, as you said, caller, that was a deliberate decision that was made to prevent people, particularly from burning to death, because unfortunately, even though it came nowhere close to the heart attack and cancer deaths, prior to that, every year, there were always hundreds of cases of people who, you know, would fall asleep while smoking, and the cigarette that did not go out would fall on their clothing or bedding or couch and start a fire. So that was the good intention beyond that. It doesn't really add a whole lot to the risk profile, and the sad reason is that's because your basic cigarette, even before they were treated to go out when they weren't being actively smoked is it's such a chemical stew. Literally thousands of chemical compounds that are either present or created by the combustion temperatures when people are inhaling on that. And of those, there's more than 100 that are known human carcinogens. So in the scheme of things, it is really not adding much of anything to the mix.
Doug Jornby is Director of Clinical Services for the Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention at UW-Madison. We're talking about how to quit smoking for good. Let's bring in Rich now in Two Rivers. Hi, Rich.
Yeah, hey, thanks for taking my phone call. Hey, I worked in the medical field for 30 years, and I actually lost a mother that bed caught fire on a new mattress that we bought her. Oh. And what I'm trying to say is I have dealt with many patients over the years, and I worked in physical therapy, and I've seen doctors' responses to patients, and they typically come at them incorrectly. I mean, they come at them like, you're not supposed to smoke. Everybody knows they're not supposed to smoke. I mean, they know they don't want to spend the money, and they know it's not good for them. But the way they come at them is kind of belligerent most of the time. And I just don't know if there's a different way, you know, help them out. Try to get them nicotine patches or something. I don't know. That's all I want to say.
Hoofda, yeah, I'm so sorry to hear about your mom. It's yeah, and you're right. We know that you know, berating people, shaming them, trying to guilt them into smoking is not an effective way. If it was just a matter of recognizing that smoking is harmful, millions of people would have quit. People, it's a very difficult dependence to overcome. People need assistance with that. And one thing I want to throw out for anyone who's listening is that there are great resources, even with all the disruption in the last couple of months. The Wisconsin Tobacco Quit Line, they were doing teletreatment way before it was cool, way before the pandemic. And the great thing is that is available at no cost to anybody in the state. And all they have to do is call 1-800-QUIT-NOW, QUITNOW, or they can text the word READY, READY, to 200-400. Either way, we'll get them connected. And the quit line is available by phone, by text, by internet, right to wherever people are. They don't have to go anywhere. They can get counseling. They can get support. And they can even get 2 weeks of, as the caller was saying, nicotine patches, nicotine gum, or nicotine lozenge to help with the withdrawal and the craving that we know is so difficult for a lot of people in the early going. So if anyone out there listening is seriously thinking about making a quit attempt, it's a wonderful resource, and I would encourage people to make full use of that.
Well, as we wrap up here in the last seconds, how can you as a family member or friend help that person quit and be an ally and not badger, as Rich was saying?
And the simple thing is just to ask. A three-letter word, but it makes a huge difference. Rather than assuming you know what is going to be best for that person, ask them, what would be supportive? Do you want me to check in and see how you're doing, or do you want me to leave that at your initiative? Worlds apart, but it makes a huge difference, and it varies from person to person. So ask them what will be best for them.
Doug, thank you for joining us.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Doug Jornby is Director of Clinical Services for the Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention at UW-Madison. He's a clinical psychologist and professor of medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. We have a link to the Wisconsin Tobacco Quit Line at WPR.org/mornings, and that number is 800-QUIT-NOW. Coming up, it's On Point. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.